This is part two of a two-part podcast. Okay, what do we got next?
Just going back to that with the water absorption and how all the plants are getting it, is that because they're, one, at different depths, and also they're connected by fungi, so that they're all, like, getting as much water as they need?
Well, I mean, the big thing with the fungi is that the fungi desperately want sugar, and it doesn't have any green leaves, and so it doesn't have like a sugar factory like the plants do. So it's basically it's worked out a symbiotic relationship to trade nutrients for sugar, mm-hmm. And then the exchange medium, the little, you know, sacks, is like water. And so sometimes a plant will have an exudate, which I wish to call plant poopies, and that's actually nutrient for a different plant. And it's like when you have a field full of carrots, then, of course, you know, a carrot doesn't want the plant poopies from the next plant over. it's like, no, I've got all the plant poopy I want. Okay. So then what happens is there's this amazing exchange of not only water, between this, you know, variety of different plants, some of which are very good at harvesting water from down deep. But there's also an exchange of nutrients. So the plant exudate, the plant poopies from an oak tree, might be plant food for a carrot. And so now the carrot's getting far more nutrients than it ever got before. And these nutrients might be things that we have documented and are probably a lot of things that we have never even thought of, let alone document. Mm. So then it's like, which is more nutritious, a plant that grows in a monocrop of carrots, or that same carrot that's growing in a polyculture, which includes 50 different species, right, all connected with this mycelium that is, you know, working at this exchange so that it can get sugar. So, and the mycelium itself is able to tap into a lot of mineral content that the plants aren't as able to tap into. And some of the mycelium could possibly be able to find water that the plants haven't been able to find. Maybe, possibly. No, nothing? Okay.
I just mean that was the point that Fred made earlier. And the efficiency thing is all coming together.
Okay. So the note I have is plants share nutrients and moisture through the fungal network. All right. Oh, no, but there's sign language going on for other communication. All right. monocrop stuff like wild pollinated grains have a living mulch of 20 species. Okay, we talked about that a little bit. Different cover crop recipe for each field. He was very emphatic about that. And I don't know, he's trying to squeeze this whole thing into an hour. I imagine he probably could spend a few days talking about all of the different recipes. Yeah, I mean, he's kind of saying like, well, what are your needs? And I'm kind of thinking like, soil. need some. I mean, we've got a bunch of sand here. I mean, of course, there's also rock, but, you know, for a lot of the berms that we've got here, as well as some of the hoogles that we've built, a lot of the hoogles contain some soil, some topsoil from the lab, but there's also a lot of sand from Arrakis. And so most of it is like we need to build topsoil. But I think we need a lot of things. Like for the berms, I like the idea of like having a massive root system getting built to kind of hold the berms together, because we've got them stacked. Very steep. Sep should be impressed, although there might be a couple of spots where it's like, that's vertical. that's got too many challenges. We might have to unvertical that a little bit. We did that one too well. But I kind of feel like, well, we need a lot of things. Let's just put a lot of things on there. I also kind of feel a lot like we're going to plant a lot of stuff that just isn't going to take very well right now, because the soil that we have on top of stuff here now is so poor. And then and on top of it, there's some spots where the soil's looking pretty good already, and it's right next to some stuff where the soil is pretty awful right now. So I kind of feel like we want a little bit of everything.
So to give an example from the Arrakis berm, there's just a very distinct line of where the berm is mostly sand and where the berm is a lot more clay. And where there's a lot more clay, there's a whole different array of plants that are growing there and just tons of stuff. And all the seeds that I threw on there have pretty much been starting to come up. But then on the sand, it's like things try to grow up, but then turkeys walk over and tumble down the sand, and that buries the little seedlings. So I think that knowing the conditions of a certain place and knowing which species will do well in those conditions is kind of what Gabe Brown was getting at.
Well, knowing what will do well, and then, like, what are your goals? And I guess, like, where the sand is, our goal is to, like, anything. Get anything. And where the sand is, there are two things that are doing okay there. One is that last spring, like late spring, we had a tub full of potatoes that we bought to eat, but they had, you know, pretty much universally started to sprout. And so we had a gal here, and she was like, give me a thing to do. And like, all these potatoes need to find a new home. And so she just went out and started sticking them everywhere. And so those made it through. I mean, you know, that weird June without any rain kind of made for a real hostile environment for potatoes or for any growy. And those potatoes made it through. And then, of course, the sunchokes. Seems like, you know, there were a couple of berms that didn't have any mulch on them at all, and they didn't have any hoogly bits inside, and then the sunchokes were at the top of this berm catching full sunlight and wind, and they made it. And then they came back the next year. So, wow, that's a durable plant. And then there's the one sunchoke plant that's just downhill of the showers, and it seems to have found that shower water. And it turns out a sunchoke can get to be a lot bigger if it has a lot of water. And that was growing on some sandy, rocky stuff, but, you know, somehow found that water. Maybe if we dug down, there's some sunchoke tubers like 3 feet down next to that water. All right. He mentioned that he's in North Dakota, and in a 6-hour period of time, there was 13.2 inches of rain that visited him and his neighbors all sudden-like.
With the average, usually for the year, is 15 inches.
Right. So this was interesting. He said, normally a major rain event is notified when there's going to be more than half an inch in one day, but this was 13.2 inches of rain in 6 hours. So his neighbor had a lake, but, he did not. And then we talked about this a little bit earlier, where it's like he got the 13.2 inches, and the very next day, you know, cause it came like 6 p.m. until midnight, something like that. And then the very next morning, he goes out and looks at his fields. Everything looks great. And there were some fields that were a little low where he could have had a lake, but he didn't have a lake. And that's when, you know, somebody else was out there and they were talking about, like, you could drive big equipment here and you wouldn't get any rutting. And so it's like, well, and then later he talks about what is the absorption rate per hour, like how many inches per hour. And it, and I can't remember what the number is now, but he'd be able to totally absorb this event.
He started with only a half inch infiltration per hour, and then after several years of polyculture and no tilling, it got to 8 inches per hour of infiltration.
So this event was no problem for him. And he also said at some point that he can hold 20 inches of rain in his soil. That would be held available, but he gets like only 16 per year. Am I saying that right? 16 per year? Is that what his number is?
think he said 15. I don't know.
Well, you know, maybe that's the number that flexes a little bit, like, you know, when he started. all right. Next, his next big segment is critters. And it seemed like there was a lot of focus being put on cattle. And then in one of the pictures he shows, the grass is definitely taller than the cattle. Now, there was this thing that he said, and we tried, he's like, there, I've got a picture of one of my bat latches. And so I think it's like a regular latch, but it's owned by Batman. You know, with the Batmobile, the Batcave, and the bat latches, the Batarangs and the bat latches. Now, he's like saying, look, there it is in the picture. And it's like, we kind of all stared at that picture and we didn't see shit.
I noticed that there was a lot of slides that he was showing the audience that they didn't put full on the video screen. So that might be that they just put the wrong picture when they made the YouTube video.
Yeah. Okay. All right. But now from his description, I'm going to assume that what it is that there's a little tiny solar panel on it. There's like a, like an electric rod or something that acts as a gate. And, there's a timer. And I think that what happens is that you set it for a certain amount of time and then, it's spring loaded and then it just automatically opens at this particular time. And then the cattle can then stroll from the paddock that they're currently in into the fresh paddock. Because the one they're currently in, it's like some asshole cow stood on that bit of food over there. I'm not going to eat that. And so it's all kind of trampled now. And so it's like, let's go to the fresh stuff where no one has trampled on it or pooped on it or peed on it or anything like that. It's all fresh.
He also seemed to emphasize that they would only graze about one third of that pasture before they needed to be moved.
30%. Right. So there are certain techniques, like Salatin recommends having them consume 90%. And he said that there would be certain scenarios that people might have them consume 90%. But then he did 30%, and he estimated that the rest of it's all trampled and not available anymore. And then, but now it's been my experience in doing paddock shift systems that when you do open the gate to the next paddock, that they all do, they're just waiting right there. Like they know what's coming and you open that gate and they all vroom right into the next paddock. And it's like the old paddock doesn't exist anymore to them. So, I imagine that what happens is that this thing is set up to like emit some kind of noise. And they know it's coming and it's about to happen or something. And it's like, oh, it opened up. And then they all race over there. And so it sounds like what they were doing was setting it up so that, they would set up a few paddocks with these bat latches. And then, they would all go off and they wouldn't have to go out there and move them into the next paddock. So I was just kind of thinking like, that sounds awesome. I want to see that, but it didn't show it. Now the 30% is eaten. The rest of it is stomped down, which then becomes the armor for the soil, which is basically just a mulch. And in a way, I think armor is a pretty good word for what happens with mulch. Because if you have bare soil and it rains, then it's like it splatters the dirt up onto the plants and stuff, which is not good. Plus a variety of other little problems. So armor, I think, is a good word. He said that he is optimizing solar energy collection. And when you look at his massive polyculture systems, I mean, it's just like this. It's a full canopy system. The soil is entirely covered with green. And trying to soak, they're competing with each other to soak up the sun. And I think that that's an excellent way of putting it. Optimizing solar energy collection. And, Joel Salatin also calls his stuff like a big solar collector. But Joel Salatin also says he's never planted a seed and this guy loves to plant seeds.
Well, he's also getting a grain crop off of his field and I don't think Joel Salatin's doing that.
I think you're right. I don't think Joel does it, because my impression is that Joel goes out and buys chicken feed, yeah, and he buys hog feed. Whereas in this system, it's like I don't think this guy would buy it. I mean, he talks later about having hogs and chickens, but I kind of wonder if he doesn't buy any feed.
I think that not only does he use his own feed, but he sells his crops as feed.
That's true. He mentioned that at one point. He's selling feed. And he also said he does not do organic certification. And I like the way that he put it. I'll have to come to my notes on that later. But he, yeah.
I think he said, I don't need to be certified for something I already know. I'm self-certifying.
I think it's more than that. I mean, if you think about it, if you're going to be certified organic by the USDA, and the USDA is run by Monsanto, I mean, that is like, why do you want to be certified by Monsanto that you're organic? And so I think what he's doing is probably above and beyond what most organic people are doing, far, far above and far beyond what most organic people are doing. So it's kind of stupid. I mean, you know, he doesn't need to be certified organic. He needs to be certified Gabe Brown, in which case he's, you know, he is the authority on his Gabe Brownitude.
Well, he also said, I'm not paying for that. My farm's always open for people. So if you wanted to come check it out, totally cool, but he's not going to pay for certification.
Yeah, organic certification does cost, but I think that the greater cost is in the paperwork that's involved in doing organic certification. My understanding is that it's like inches per month of paperwork, and that's inches in a stack of papers that need to be filled out every month to do it.
Per species, if he would have to certify each species with its own set of paperwork, and in a polyculture with a 200 seed mix, oh my gosh, you couldn't certify that organic.
And if a cow comes by and poops on that, it might, you know, no longer be acceptable.
True. From watching other Gabe Brown videos, I can't quite remember, but I know that a lot of no-till farmers that use a lot of cover crops also will, well, they use the cover crops in rotation. So they'll grow like a big crop of, you know, something to just cover the ground 1 year, and then the next year, because those things are continually growing and keep growing, they actually use herbicides to come through and kill those crops off so they can plant into it. I'm not sure what Gabe Brown's, I can't remember if he uses that, but he may use herbicides to kill some of his fields off, if I remember correctly.
I hope that that is not the case, but it does sound like it took him some time to wean himself off of the chemicals. But I kind of got the impression that he's not using any pesticides of any kind. Now, herbicides, I've always thought, fall underneath the pesticide umbrella. Because under pesticides, you've got your fungicides and your insecticides and everything. So,
I mean, if you're considering your own cover crops pests, I don't know that that's exactly true. You know, they're in the way, but, you know,
okay,
just kill them off. I don't know. I'm not
that would make though. So let's suppose for a moment that he is using herbicides. That would make me very sad. However, the thing is that the stuff that he's proven with this video is still profound. And then, you know, I think he can find a way to grow past that. But I thought he said at some point that he's not using any.
Yeah, he said he lets the animals just trample it and then seeds right afterwards. And if there's no cash crop available with that time of year, he sowed another cover crop.
If he is using herbicides, he certainly didn't show any pictures of like, here I am spraying the herbicides. Yeah. And it does seem like what Sean's saying is true, is that it's like after everything, I mean, he's got that no-till drill that he clearly loves. And so why would he, if he wants to no-till drill something, what? I guess he could spray herbicides because he wants to do a different set of cover crops for one reason or another. You know, exactly like what you're saying. Like, now we're going to rotate stuff in and out or whatever.
I mean, I, I'm pretty sure he said he didn't use any inputs on a lot of that stuff, and he really stressed several times that he liked to sign the back of the check, not the front. So I think if he was using herbicides at one time, I don't think he is anymore.
I think that's the case, too. I hope that's the case. I'm going to pretend it's the case because it makes me like him more. Yeah. Okay. Here was a profound thing. And this is something, this is the first I've heard of this. And I like it and I want to echo it a lot. Higher quality soil leads to longer growing seasons. So he was talking about frost sensitive plants that normally would die mid-September, but now they are lasting to mid-October because of the better soil. And I thought that was incredible. You're saying because of all the soil activity, all the life in the soil, it warms the soil. And that extends the season.
I thought the season was extended because he had so many different crops growing all together. Because it was a polyculture, because he had so many layers and a canopy, then there was a protection of the, from frost.
They're all cuddling up and keeping each other warm?
Yeah, and humid. Yeah.
So I think that there could be some possibility that that could be part of it. Now, I do remember that he specifically stated that he felt it was because of the soil biology, the activity in the soil, all that life was giving off heat. Okay. That's what he said. But I think it could be a little of column A and a little of column B.
Yeah, I think he said that the cover crops were insulating the soil as part of that season extension. So they're helping, dead cover crops are insulating the soil to keep that soil life living, and maybe then the soil life is helping to keep the plant.
Yeah, I'm on brain-addling medications. That's my excuse for possibly missing him saying that. But, okay. I do know that, of course, in the heat, then, you know, it'll be exactly the same, but totally different. The soil temperature was 20 degrees cooler when you had that full canopy. But I could see if you've got a full canopy of plants that tolerate the cold, that like, you know, kale or something. Like I say, you got tons of kale, and in between the kale, you've got a bunch of stuff that's very frost sensitive, and but then somehow the frost didn't hit it because the kale got it. So then, of course, the temperature of the soil might be warmer because it hasn't gotten that cold yet. And so then, so maybe the top, like if there's a frost sensitive plant and it's 2 feet tall and the kale's 1 feet tall, the top half of that plant might, you know, get killed by the frost, but the bottom half of the plant lives for another month. Possibly. I just made that up. I don't know if it's true or not. Okay.
Back when he was talking about armor on the soil, he did say that the residue buffers the soil temperature 20 degrees. And he said at 70 degrees, 100% of the soil moisture goes to plant growth. But when the soil temperature gets up to 100 degrees, only 15% of the soil moisture is contributing to plant growth. So the other 85% is lost to evaporation and transpiration.
Yeah, typical mulching kind of stuff. Okay. He runs a hayless operation, and he had somebody up visiting, and they're saying like, oh, we got all this equipment for, you know, harvesting the hay on, you know, 1,000 acres a year. And then that's what we feed back to our animals. And we've got all this equipment for storing the, you know, baling the hay and putting the hay up. And then we got other equipment for like taking the hay down and feeding it to the animals. And we go out twice a day and feed them hay. And it's like, well, and then the question came back to him and his son, like, well, what do you guys use in the wintertime in order to be able to feed your animals? And the son apparently said something about a recliner. And he's wearing out these recliners in his house, sitting in them all day, you know. And so basically they've got a hayless system. And between the hayless system and the bat latches, it sounds like these cattle can move themselves from paddock to paddock through the winter. They said something like they fired up their tractor one time last winter. They had, I don't know, 350 cow-calf pairs, something like that. And so it sounds like a lot of the polycultures, they leave behind a lot of edible residue, and some of them are still making a go of it in the middle of winter, and the cows will go out there and dig it up and eat it. And so he kind of makes this point of, like, why do I want to do the haying thing if I don't have to? And so, yay, hayless systems.
He also made a point that you have to make sure that you have the right species that can handle being outside all winter.
Right, and then there's going to be species, like, I mean, I'm going to guess that he was probably doing a lot of mangle beets, kale. I want to keep saying sunchokes, but he didn't grow any sunchokes.
I think Sarah meant species of animals.
I meant species of animals, but that's an interesting
point. Oh, okay, all right. I didn't see any species that looked any different from what you normally see around here. It looked like, you know, Angus, Black Bolly, Hereford. I was kind of thinking, like, oh, he's probably going to have Scottish Highland show up in the next slide, but nope, no Scottish Highland. It all looked like the same stuff normal breeds.
Well, you're talking about Montana. Normal breeds around here might be different than Texas.
Well, that's true, but he's in North Dakota,
so it should be similar.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
That's why they didn't look any strange to you, because
right. Yeah, you probably don't want to have, like, longhorn, you know. Although some people around here do have longhorn, and it looks like they don't have much wool on them. And I kind of think, man, that's going to be a cold animal come winter. But the other thing is that where he is in North Dakota, that's flat country out there, and we've got these windbreaks that we call the Rocky Mountains. And so I think it slows the wind down a fair bit down here in the valleys. You know, we might get an occasional windy day, but when it gets to be 40 below, and there's, like, not a lot of wind, it's crisp, but it's not nearly as bad. If you're out in North Dakota, it's 40 below and the wind's blowing 60 miles an hour. So, I, in northeastern Oregon, I spent a lot of time living with my granddad and on a 500-acre cattle ranch, and it was all Angus, Hereford, and Black Bolly. Black Bolly being a cross between Angus and Hereford. And it's kind of like, that's kind of the same stuff looked like he had on his place when he showed us those pictures. There was that one picture where it was like, see that thing out there? That's all the cows kind of bunched together when it's 40 below. And it's like it was a big black gob. I was thinking, like, well, maybe those are all Angus, because it was just a black blob. But, all right. Next test. Oh, next extremely profound image. And he said that he took this field and they measured it. They did a soil test. And the soil test said that there was 10 pounds of nitrogen per acre. And that means that you need to add a lot of nitrogen per acre if you're going to grow corn, which is what he's going to do. He's going to grow corn, and it's like 10 pounds per acre is nuts. To try and grow corn on that is going to be some seriously sad corn. It might not even tassel. There might be no corn at all. But he had 10 pounds per acre, and then he went ahead and planted the corn. The corn grew up, and then, as I said earlier, the county average is just below 100 bushels per acre, and so he might come back with 7 bushels per acre. Instead, he came back with 142. This enormous amount of corn per acre. And he showed it as it's growing, and it looked dark green and healthy, which when you're low on nitrogen, your plants usually come out looking yellow and pathetic and sad and like they're crying and they hate you because you fucked up their life forever. You're a miserable plant steward. But these were awesome looking corn plants, and 142 bushels is very, very good. He mentioned that it has to do with the soil biology. So basically, when you've got an excellent soil biology, that you don't need that nitrogen. And nitrogen is, you know, one of the ones that's free in the air. So it's kind of like all you need is a way to get it, you know, into those plant roots. Because, like, corn does not take nitrogen in directly from the air. It needs it to be handed to it through its roots in certain formats. Lots and lots of soil testing. The guy that is his old buddy for soil tests came out to his place because he couldn't believe it and did all kinds of tests. And now this buddy, Ward Labs, will do a different kind of soil test based upon Gabe Brown's standards, I guess. And that's basically what Gabe Brown is saying, is like, take the old soil test standards and the old ways of doing agronomy, throw that out the window, and here's a whole new way of farming. And so it requires a whole different kind of soil test. So Ward Labs will do a soil test for you for $50 per test, and it's going to be based upon this different kind of thing to be testing. I thought that was profound! Okay. Anybody else got anything at this point?
Well, just to add on to what you just said, he said to focus on what the soil needs, not what the plants need. And I think a lot of us have been gardening a while. That's a pretty, you know, you think tomatoes need such and such more so than carrots. You're tempted to want to try to add that in. But he's saying to focus on the soil, not the plants.
Well, I think that that is definitely a good way to look at it. I feel like if you look at what the plants need is a lot of the stuff that's in Gabe's soil. And I think that the problem isn't so much at looking what the plants need is how we look at what the plants need. And that is that, why is it we always look at this elemental stuff? I mean, like, even the nitrogen, none of the nitrogen that gets into the plant is available in a pure nitrogen format. It's always going to be nitrite, nitrate, ammonia, this long, long list of possible nitrogen-based packages. But all we do is we talk about, like, the nitrogen, the element. And then we talk about, you know, the big three are NPK. So we've got some phosphorus and potassium there too. And then, of course, there's a long list of micronutrients and, you know, all the different things that, you know, it's like, oh, this plant is sad. It's because it doesn't have enough iron. And so all that stuff. But what I'm thinking is that it's going to be different kinds of molecules, different kinds of substances that are made of these elements. And there's the ones that we know of. But I'm kind of thinking that there might be a much longer list of stuff that we don't know of. So even if we're going to talk about nitrogen, it's like there might be 250 different nitrogen packages, some of which we don't even know exist yet. And I imagine that when you've got polyculture in an old soil with good soil structure and lots of mycelium, then this buffet is now available to the plant. All these things that we never really knew of. And that this is where the true nutrient in the plant is coming from. But now Gabe is doing things in polycultures that are amazing polycultures, getting amazing results. But it seems like it's still broadacre. And it seems driven by that no-till drill that he has. I kind of wonder what's going to happen if he does more food forests, if he's going to do a lot more with perennials, especially trees. So I'm just curious. It's like, dear Gabe Brown, could you please do this with a lot more trees? Thanks, permaculture people.
Dear Paul Wheaton, how do I harvest those grains now that there's trees in the way?
With a scythe. I'm glad we had this chat. Now, I believe, and my, you know, granted, he's working 5,000 acres. It just seems like a hell of a lot. And I would like to see a lot more of the stuff where we have, like, anywhere from 5 to 100 acres per person. I think the biggest single permaculture plot I'd like to hear about is 200 acres. And even then, it's got, like, a dozen people on it. a dozen permies, a dozen gardeners on it. And I think effectively what Gabe Brown is proving, and now of course he's proving his own thing, but I'm going to, just for my own special fantasies, plot my stuff onto what Gabe has shown. And that is that, you know, gardening. I mean, in a way, he's kind of like, it's as if he's gardening. He's making these enormous polyculture gardens. So, and it's like, and it's working! I mean, when we talk about organic matter, it seems to me like your standard field has, you know, 2% organic matter, and it's like, meh, you should probably get some more than that. Then you get to 5% organic matter, it's kind of like, okay, you're good. You don't have to work so hard now. Hold it at 5%. A gardener, when they get good soil, they get it up to 10%. And then you got this amazing soil. And now it sounds like Gabe Brown in this video, he was just starting to see some of his fields cross the 10% line for the first time.
11.1%.
11.1% was what one of his fields just came back with. So it's kind of like, well, isn't, you know, working with an amazing garden soil super effective? And I think that's basically what he has proven here. But it's like how he got there is what's really amazing. And it's like the fact that it's like suddenly all these farmers might start becoming large-scale gardeners like Gabe Brown. And, of course, I don't think Gabe Brown probably thinks of himself as a large-scale gardener. But that's okay. That's cool. He's awesome by the standards of Gabe Brown. And so go Gabe. I would prefer to see, like, if we're going to talk about grain, I mean, one of the things is this kind of like, if you're going to be a gardener or you're going to have like 4 acres or something like that, hard to justify the expense of a combine. But, you know, when you got a combine, wow, I got to tell you, cause a few of us here have driven combines. They sure harvest the wheat fast. and they sure get it from that, you know, on the stalk to the just the grains thing quick. Whereas if you ever tried to do that by hand, it's like that's slow going. So and then of course a lot of the permaculture stuff that we read is like, okay, A, should we even be eating grains? B, it used to be that if you got a birthday cake, that was crazy ass expensive because somebody had to fucking harvest that grain and get all the chaff off and shit like that in order to, and then grind it up. And it was like, it was a lot of fucking work to make a cake. And so grain was expensive. But you know, we eventually got this equipment to make it so much easier to harvest. Now there's getting to be more and more stuff in this space about, you know, threshers and winnowers and things like that are more home scale, but, you know, they're much better than beating it with a stick and, you know, pouring it in front of a fan. So we're getting better, but it's still the scythe. And, I think I have a video that shows a few different ways of threshing grain. And the winnowing is still pouring it in front of a fan, which kind of is what a combine does. So that's not a big deal.
Just plan for a windy day.
Or you could do that. You could do that. All right. That corn test was amazing. And then he showed soil tests for when, like, he had a field, and that's like, okay, on this field, we're going to not run any animals. And on the field, you know, that's right next to it, that's like exactly the same, we are going to run animals. And now let's test the soil again. And the soil test came back that the field loved the animals. It was very happy. He was trying to make the point that animals in the landscape are very helpful. The soil can now hold 20 inches of water. And then he decided to do a dry land garden, 30 acres. Because, you know, if you've got a no-till drill, why not just fill it up with garden stuff and drive out there on 30 acres? And you got 5,000 acres. It's like, how big is your garden? So it sounds like he said that what they ate for a long time was whatever he happened to trip over. And then they gave all the rest of it to people in the area that wanted it.
And then he grazed it.
Yeah, and then he grazed it. And so I was kind of thinking like, okay, let's find out what you grew that was different from, you know, what you're normally growing. I would have liked it, but he was running out of time, so he had to start going a hell of a lot faster. Another thing was, is that, you know, Joel Salatin talks about fiefdoms. Like, he wants to have on his property a bunch of different fiefdoms, which I always kind of felt like, that's not quite the right word. It doesn't sit well. And so Gabe had, he called it stacking enterprises, which I think is the exact same thing that Joel Salatin talks about with fiefdoms, which is that there might be, either 15 different business models, 20 different business models that he's doing himself, or there might be 20 different business models and there's 20 different people. Each one's doing a different business model, all on the same land. And each business model is in a symbiotic relationship with all the other business models. And so, you know, a great example that Joel has is that, I mean, of course, you've got one person who might run through with cattle, another person might come by with chickens after that, another person might have hogs after that. And then on the same land, there's another person who's got a timber business going with the, you know, harvesting the trees, another person's doing something with mushrooms, and another person is doing something with perhaps honeybees. So all of these things are on the same chunk of land, but they're all different businesses that are overlaid on top of each other, and each one helps the others. So stacking enterprises, I think, is a better word. Oh, I'm almost to the end of the list. This here was an interesting thing that he said, that for each insect pest that a farmer might hate, that is, you know, that Colorado potato beetle is eating my stuff, I hate you, that for every pest, there are 1,700 beneficial species. And he showed a picture. When he's talking about this, he showed a picture, and it was in the morning, and there was thousands of spider webs everywhere and dew on all the spider webs, which is almost exactly the same kind of picture that comes from Fukuoka's stuff.
I wonder what some of the beneficial species are for the potato bug.
I'm well, if nothing else, by looking at that picture, spiders. And there's got to be, you know, at least 1,000 species of spiders. But for the Colorado potato beetle, I like to think from the permaculture perspective that if a Colorado potato beetle is eating your potato plant, then that potato plant shouldn't have been there. So right now we have a rhubarb plant that's right outside the office door. And in the morning I've been throwing coffee grounds on it. And every once in a while, when Janet's not around, then I'll go and pee at the base of it. And if Janet is within an hour of here, it seems like she just pops up out of nowhere whenever I want to give a little liquid love to that rhubarb plant. if you look at it, you'll notice that a bunch of the leaves on it are full of holes. Mm-hmm. Now, we can speculate over, like, well, is it slugs? Is it funguses? Is it, you know, some kind of insect out there gnawing on it?
Urine hitting it too hard.
Power urine. Yeah, because I'm old and have power urine. Super urine. So, it could be anything, but really the answer is, who gives a shit? That rhubarb plant is doing really well in a way, and in another way, it's not doing so well. It's losing some of its leaves to something. But that berm is just a little over a year old, and we're currently building the soil inside of it. Once the soil gets to be much, much better, that rhubarb plant will probably get to be much, much healthier. Now, at the same time, there were a couple of other rhubarb plants I planted last year at the same time as that one that didn't make it. And, you know, part of it was that I planted it, like, I don't know, too late in the season. And then the rain didn't come that was supposed to come throughout June. And so that was part of it. But this one did make it. And, I'm kind of thinking that, right now we've got a bit of a polyculture growing all over that berm. And then, at the end of the year, the soil will be richer and better. We've got a lot more mulch on the berm this year, and so it's looking like it will be better, but it's going to take time. And I kind of feel like a lot of the gardens that are here now are not going to really hit their stride for a few more years. And so the same can be said for, you know, what were we talking about? The Colorado potato beetle. So there's a bunch of, you know, potato plants here and there, and some will do better than others. And most of them will probably do much better as the soil gets better and better and better. And then those plants will effectively become a flavor of bulletproof. The fact that it's doing poorly in a way, I'm not really concerned about it. I think that in a couple of years, it'll do much better without me doing anything for the plant. Normally, people think of exactly what you're thinking of. Those Colorado potato beetles are pissing me off. I'm going to hire a fucking hit squad to take them out. And
chickens.
Okay, chickens, you bet. The spiders. There's probably, you know, a couple hundred species of parasitic wasp that'd probably do something. There's probably a bunch of insects that are like so tiny we can't see them with our naked eye that totally piss off the Colorado potato beetle. And the more we have the Colorado potato beetles here, then the more that the things that think Colorado potato beetles are tasty will show up. Mm-hmm. Same thing like when we had the chipmunks and then the stoat showed up. And then eventually the neighborhood cat. And now we don't have the problems that we once had. Just keep that food coming around, and eventually whatever eats it will show up. There's always a bigger fish. Fred, do you have something?
Well, I think the point he was trying to make was saying how many beneficial species there are compared to the one pest, was that the typical response is like, oh, well, let's throw some poison on that one pest. But in the meantime, you're also hurting all those other species that aren't, you know, negative or even beneficial.
And I think those beneficial species take a lot longer to build up. Mm. I mean, you know, songbirds, sparrows, maybe even ugly birds. How about praying mantis? You know, the more general insect eaters. But yeah, they're usually going to take longer to establish. The beneficials are going to take much longer to establish. And the pests kind of come and go rather quickly. So anyway, all right. He said something about how he has something where he goes and he sells his meat directly. So he went and he set up a butchering shop because there wasn't any in his area. So now he can sell his meats directly. And he said that he went and he would, he had some kind of thing at a farmer's market, it sounded like, or something like that. And then, he would sell a steak for $20 a pound. He would sell all of it. He would be sold out. And he likes the idea that he could sell somebody a steak for $20 a pound and they would thank him. Thank you. So, brownsranch.us is his website. And that is the end of my notes. Who's got more notey bits to cover in this podcast?
Well, I found one that was pretty interesting. He talked about using high carbon biennials, and then he talked about letting the animals graze on it when there was more carbon in it, and it was not as preferable to let the animal graze it for the animal itself, but he seemed pretty into the fact that it was better for the land. So I just found that really interesting that somebody would go through and graze it when there's more carbon instead of nitrogen.
Well, okay, so a cow is a beer-making machine. And so then the cow goes out and gathers up a bunch of organic matter, puts it into the beer-making machine, and then kind of has a look on its face of like somebody who sits at a bar all day drinking beer, and chews its cud and processes all the beer. And then there's all of the stuff that, after you've made the beer, the stuff that was not beer that all comes out the back end. But now that's rather biologically active, because it's a biological beer making process. So, yeah, there's all of that stuff. So like, let's say that grass that's on the surface just sits there It's like, it's grass that sticks straight up, and then it turns yellow. It kind of, you know, goes dormant and turns yellow. And, so now where did all that, so it went from green to yellow. During that process of going from green to yellow, the green stuff is a nitrogen of sorts. And if that green stuff as nitrogen can get to the soil, then it's going to feed the soil, feed the plants. But if it doesn't, then, it's going to be, denitrification. It's just going to go up into the atmosphere and be unavailable to the plants. So now you're talking about carbon, and it's a similar kind of a thing for the carbon. I mean, the carbon is going to oxidize and become carbon dioxide, and it's going to – so eventually that plant stock will just decompose into nothingness, and none of it will go into the soil unless there's some way of getting it into the soil. Animals help to get it into the soil before it goes up in the atmosphere. Did I paint a picture that is a response to what you were saying, or am I just babbling?
I'm not sure. I found it really interesting that he would actually send his animals in there to, at a time that wasn't the best food for the animal. Because he said it'd be better for the animal if it wasn't high in carbon, but no, I'm going to try to send the animal in there when it's really high in carbon. And he kind of alluded to the fact it was better for the land itself.
Okay. I think what he was trying to say is that, like, a lot of times when you're getting ready to sell your animals, mm-hmm. then you're going to fatten them up really mm-hmm. fast. And then you'll feed them a different kind of thing. And so what he was saying is that if I wanted to do that, then what I'm going to do, I would have waited a little bit before putting them into this particular field. But I don't want to do that right now. And so, for example, if it's a cow with a calf, do you want the cow to, like, bulk up? No, you're going to keep that cow many, many years, and you want that cow to probably stay about the same size. So, then it's like, no, that would, you know, you might give that pasture to some different kind of animal that's like a steer, where it's like, oh, we're going to harvest that steer in a month. So we're going to put it into this different kind of pasture where they're going to gain much faster. And then now there's a lot of debate about the protein content of different kinds of things that a cow could graze on or steer could graze on. And whether or not how much does that matter? After all, we're kind of like changing the way we think about what cattle eat, as well as, in this case, you know, what we're going to plant in the ground and how we're going to fertilize and how we're going to treat the soil. So there's a lot of discussion about, like, what cattle really need is high carbon, low nitrogen, whereas the old school of thought has been high nitrogen, low carb.
So it's more of like, instead of that, it's not so much that it's not good for the animal, but it's maybe not good for profiting from that animal, right?
I would say that it's going to be, I mean, it's, I think what he was saying at that point was that it didn't have as much nitrogen in it when he was putting these animals in, mm-hmm. that the food that was available for these animals was more carbon, less nitrogen. And he was thinking that that was good, that he wanted that for this particular bunch of animals. Mm-hmm. But that if he was going to run steers in that might be going to market soon, he might wait another month a couple more weeks.
I think it was that it's past the point that he would have run steers. He waited, and those grasses became more carbonish.
Possibly.
Is that what you're saying?
Saying makes more sense, but all I remember is that he was saying that he would have run animals, he would have run different animals later. But I was thinking that he was saying that right now he's running these animals because this animal or this land doesn't have as high of a protein as it would later.
I think he was saying, I think it's what Sean is saying, is that he was doing it because that was the most beneficial time for the land, because he wanted the most armor on the soil.
Okay. That's a good reason too. So, all right. we could watch it again, or you know, actually, I encourage whoever's listening to this to watch this video. It was extremely good, extremely important. And the only reason why I watched it is because it kept coming up in conversations at Permies. I mean, I think the video was embedded in like four different threads at Permies, and people kept referring to it as they were talking about stuff. And so I finally watched it, and I found it to be extremely profound. And then I'm like, hey, come watch this, everybody. And then Kai's, you know, sitting down, and he's like, oh, I've already seen this. And so it's like, oh, I guess, you know, I'm not bringing you. But, of course, gobs and gobs of people on Permies knew about this long before I did. And it's quite good. All right. Any other notes? Last call. If you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about soil, homesteading, and permaculture all the time.